First of all, thank you very much, Anna, for the introduction. So no pressure on me at all to perform well, but I will do my best to live up to this reputation that you say I have. It's really nice to be here at Yamk in Jyväskylä. I've been here a few times before, and I always enjoy coming back. It's a lovely place with lovely people. And I'm particularly pleased to come here to the seminar today, because one of the pleasures that is fairly rare for academics is to be able to actually talk about what interests them. Most of the time you are lecturing, and I'm not saying I'm not interested in that, but you are kind of pre-programmed, this is what you have to do, kind of flick the switch, module 107BS, right, here I go, here is an hour's worth of pre-recorded material. I could simply go ahead and repeat this somewhere else, probably not thinking very much about it. But yes, we are humans. We do actually have our own foibles, our own interests, the own particular things that we like. And a seminar like this is always an opportunity to talk about them. And the one I'm going to talk about today is something that in English is known as the elephant in the room. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with that expression, so I will explain it. The elephant in the room is an idea. Everybody knows about this idea, or at least in the early days they knew about it. But because it's a little bit embarrassing, you don't really want this elephant in the room, you start to ignore it. And over time, you almost forget that there is this elephant in the room, until somebody comes along and says, hey, what about this elephant in the room? Look, we need to talk about this. We can't keep on ignoring it. And what I'm going to talk about today that I think is the elephant in the room in sports management is, what is the relationship between sport management as an academic subject and mainstream business management? And perhaps I need to tell you a little bit about my personal history to explain why I'm in the position I am today. I started academically in mainstream business. I'd got an MBA in a British university. I was asked to teach there on their evening program. It grew into a full-time job, and I had 3 years at De Montfort University, where I was the business pathway leader. So you can guess from that job title, it was absolutely mainstream business. At that stage in my life, if you said sport management to me, I'd have said, sorry, what? In those days, it didn't exist. I'm talking about in the early 1990s. There was no subject sport management. There were no degree programs. There were certainly no textbooks. And in 1995, I moved to Coventry University, and fairly quickly, for rather peculiar reasons that I won't go into, it's another story altogether, an X-rated story, I should say, I was asked, will you start a degree in sport management? And I have to be honest, this was 1997, I think it was. I'd say, but I know nothing about sport management. There are no books about sport management. You're asking the impossible of me. They said, oh, go on, please. And to cut a long story short, I said, oh, all right. And I wrote this program, developed it, recruited some more staff. We already had some staff who were certainly capable of doing this. And we developed this sport management program within Coventry Business School. And we were a little bit constrained, I think probably on the grounds of economy. They said, well, you must establish certain core modules from the business program that you will build into your program, because that will save money. You can't have your own completely freestanding program. I said, okay, that sounds reasonable. So, was particularly in the second year program We had core modules on human resource management, organizational behavior, marketing, finance, strategy. So it was over half the program in the second year was absolutely identical to the program of the students doing BA Business Studies and BA Business Management. It seemed logical at the time. Why not? Sport management surely is simply one variation on a general management theme. Fairly quickly, we realized this isn't actually working very well. In some areas, it's okay. Organizational behavior, certainly there weren't major difficulties there. But as soon as we came to things like marketing and finance, it just wasn't meeting the needs of our students. What we were teaching to mainstream business simply wasn't appropriate. So we were teaching some of the wrong things, it seemed, well, wrong in the sense irrelevant, but we're also missing out large parts that we should have been teaching to sport management students. So after a bit of a battle, I began to extract our students from the mainstream business program and got to the stage where the sport management program was entirely separate. After I retired, the powers that be brought in further austerity, and they've now moved back to using some of the Common Core subjects, which I find quite frightening. Please don't tell them I said that. But it does worry me. And I do wonder how much debate there was about, is this sensible? Is it the right thing? Is it good for students? Does it make any sense? And I think if I try to kind of put into summary what I think is wrong with this approach of simply saying sport management is just one variation on a theme. I should perhaps mention at Coventry we also had tourism management and we have very similar problems with that. To a lesser degree, I'd have to be honest, but there were the same kind of problems. There were areas where it could be Common Core, but there were distinctly specialist areas that we needed to teach. So what really worried me was we were going down the road of believing that, well, what do you think the message of that is saying, or saying, don't believe this? It's really saying the idea that one size fits all is complete nonsense. A clear demonstration with his trousers. Clearly they do not fit him. The one size fits all as an approach does not in general make a great deal of sense. To the extent that it can actually make it impossible to function if you believe one size fits all. There's a classic example from the world of engineering. How do we do this job? You do it with a spanner. Yes, but you can't do it with any spanner. You have to have the right size of spanner. You have to have the right version in order to get something to work. And that's what I feel about sport management. You can take some mainstream management theory, but you need to modify it, you need to adapt it, you need to have the right size for it to work, the right adaptation. Because if you don't, if you try and take a general mainstream theory and you stretch it and you stretch it and you stretch it to make it fit, then stretching things to make them fit doesn't always work. You need to look a little bit carefully to see where the stretching has gone wrong. I hope you can see that in this light. Okay, you don't need to examine too closely, but her trousers, I think it is, have just been stretched a little bit too far and a disaster from stretching it to make it fit. Now, was I alone in having these worries about whether sport management was simply a variation? Probably not, but I didn't meet many people who were willing to discuss it. Certainly within the university, there was almost a culture of, we've been told to do it this way, therefore we will do it this way, without any kind of counter-challenge of saying, hang on a minute, is this sensible? Does it work? Will it work? And the first kind of big fellow thinker, if you like, I use the word fellow loosely because I'm not in any way equating myself, but the first kind of occurrence of in the public media of people thinking the same way was really the European Union suddenly woke up and said, yeah, there are some problems here. They were thinking mainly from the perspective of law. They were saying sport as business is really quite different from mainstream business. We'll see in a minute the areas they identified as being different and not fitting into a mainstream business model. But they were arguing that perhaps we need to have special laws. The usual laws of business don't make sense when applied to sport. We have issues, for example, with competition law, with employment law. Now, we're all familiar with the idea that players are bought and sold. That is standard practice in professional sport. Doesn't make sense, really, does it? But it is the standard practice. It wouldn't make sense in universities. Supposing Yavaskala wanted me to come and work here, they wouldn't put in an offer to my agent, and then my agent wouldn't negotiate and then turn around and say, okay, look, John, I've got you this really great deal with Yamk. They're going to provide for your family to come over. They're going to put your children, well, my grandchildren, it would be into school if I was bringing my family. It just doesn't work like that in the world of sport. There is something special there. So do we need special employment law? Do we need special employment law to keep people at work? We've seen in many football leagues in particular throughout Europe, they now have windows for transfer. You can only transfer players in the summer and for the month of January. Why? Because if we allowed players just to change clubs when they liked, it would give no stability at all. We need more stability, so we need to stop people moving from their jobs. Now, if you tried to introduce that, for example, in a university, there would be rioting. How dare you tell me I cannot move to another university? They've made me a better offer. If I choose to go, I will go. It's about personal freedom. And that's true in every sector except sport. So the EU were establishing some special issues.
My bad. I turn it off.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Yes, I can forgive you for turning it off.
Or I go off.
Right. Okay, so they came up with this term, the specificity of sport. Now, that was my first problem with the EU on that, was that's not actually a proper English word, specificity. Specificity is a term from physics to do with holding heat when you heat up metals. So it was a misuse of an English word. I think what they really meant was the uniqueness. What is it that makes sport as business unique, and what is specific about that? And that's why they kind of regenerated this wrong word, specificity. And that was set out in a white paper, a discussion document, that is to use the EU, special EU language, a white paper is the discussion document. And it was incorporated, the principles were incorporated in the Treaty of Lisbon. So it has an EU-wide status that, yes, sport as business is different from mainstream sport. They started to look at in what ways it was different, and these are some of the main ones they picked out. The principle of free movement and free movement related to nationality. Hang on a minute. You're kicking off with nationalism in the sense that we're defining players as members of a nation. Players have a passport, and that's the starting point for a major part of what happens in sport. Doesn't happen in any other business. Aldi, if they wanted, as a German supermarket, to open a supermarket in Finland, they wouldn't have issues about, oh, can we bring in any German supermarket managers? If they wanted to, they can. There is free movement across the EU. Yeah, that's problematic when it comes to sport, because in sport, we like to keep our nationhood, our nationality, our passport. We are, in a sense, defined by it. Creates all sorts of problems, as we've just seen in the Winter Olympics and the problems with whether to ban Russia. Yes, we will. But are we going to ban Russian nationals? Well, that's a different question. That's, shall we or shan't we ban them on individual basis? And if we don't ban them, we'll let them play, but not as Russians. They have to play as kind of non-people under this non-nation banner, even though everybody knows they're Russian. So there are issues there that are unique to sport, and they simply don't occur in mainstream business. I'm going to use supermarkets quite often as the comparison. There's nothing special about supermarkets, but it's just handy because they are one of the mainstream businesses that do operate internationally. So it gives us a good comparison. So there's the right to select your national athletes, that you need to introduce limits. We've had problems in sport there. I can think of a case where a guy with born in England, Afro-Caribbean father, an immigrant, mother born in, I think, London, her parents, well, her father, so that's his grandfather, was born in Scotland. So Scotland said, he's Scottish. He can play football for Scotland. Because under our rules, if you have one grandparent who's born in Scotland, then you're Scottish. Not even thinking, well, it's a little bit of a problem because it means that one person could actually have four nationalities if their grandparents came from different countries. So we're getting into a really complex world, a world where there's great opportunities for argument, for discussion, but these are serious matters, whether somebody can or can't represent their country. They are important not only to that individual, but very often to the country. We had an example in the 1984 Olympics where South Africa was banned from participating in the Olympics. And they had a very promising middle distance runner called Zola Budd. And because she was South African, then that was it. Goodbye, Zola, you're not competing. And she said to the British government, I have a British grandparent. Could I possibly have a British passport? And within 10 days, the UK were welcoming her as our new middle distance runner at the Olympics. It all went disastrously wrong because she accidentally, I think, tripped up Mary Decker in the finals and didn't do anything like as well as it was hoped. But it was a big international incident. Lots of countries were saying, well, that's not fair. Why should she run for the UK? And the UK was saying, well, it's not fair that she's banned from running because she happens to be a South African. So a whole kind of argument that's never going to happen in the world of supermarkets. And another area to do with free movement, this, the setting of deadlines for transfers. I've mentioned that, the idea of a transfer window. You can only change employer if you're a professional sports person at certain times. At other times, you are simply locked in with that employer. If you resigned, then you can't take up employment with somebody else. Now, again, I use universities. If I resigned from Coventry University and Yamp said, hey, John, fantastic, you're free, come and work for us. And I'd say, no, I'm sorry, under the university rules across Europe, I'm not allowed to transfer. I'm happy to come to you in September, but I can't come now. I mean, it's ludicrous. But it does make sense in the world of sport. So these are some of the other areas that this Treaty of Lisbon, they picked out as this is where sport as business is different and where it needs special laws. So the areas of transfers, agents, probably the world of theatre and film is the only other industry sector that has agents representing you if you are a top performer in that particular area. So it's not unique to sport, but sport is one of the very few areas where you have agents operating. Protection of minors, this was a particular concern of the EU. There were some very bad examples of, particularly from West Africa, people saying they were agents and recruiting children and telling the parents, we will place your child in a football academy with Chelsea or with Arsenal or with Manchester United, or all across Europe, in fact, not especially England. And there are examples where that child was then flown to, I remember a classic example, flown to Brussels because the parents had been told they'd been signed by a Belgian football club academy. The child arrived in Belgium, no one to meet them at the airport, end of it, just totally abandoned. And this was beginning to happen on a worrying scale. Now, again, this doesn't happen with supermarkets. You don't find recruitment agents going around Africa saying, psst, I can get your child a good position working for Aldi or for Lidl. Hand them over to me, I'll fly them to Germany and they've got a brilliant career in the future. Simply doesn't happen. So sport is different. Competition laws, I've mentioned. Money laundering, there was a very interesting report a few years ago showing in theoretical terms why football in particular, if you wanted to launder money, by God, it was so easy if you bought a football club. I can remember being asked on a BBC radio programme live, really put me on the spot. So, well, John, how do you go about it if you want to launder money through a football club? And I was sitting there on live radio thinking, well, I know how, but should I be telling people? Because it is incredibly easy. And I'm afraid it probably says something about me. Within a second, I said, well, what you need to do is, and I explained, I'm not going to repeat how to do it. You'll have to look through BBC archives if you want to find out the secrets. But it is incredibly easy. It's all to do with the lack of regulation, particularly in England. We're really not good on controlling who owns clubs. We're not good on controlling how they operate. We're not good in limiting the way they operate. It is ridiculously easy to launder money through a football club. Other forms of financial crime, well, I'm not going to dig a bigger hole and get myself into further trouble by going into that. Licensing system for clubs. Well, yes, don't have it for supermarkets. Don't need it for supermarkets. You do need it in professional sport. And I think probably this is at the one of the key points about why sport is different is we're very often, in most sports, we're talking about clubs operating in leagues. And they are unique in the business world in that, yes, they compete, as you would do in any kind of business sector, but that as leagues, they have to collaborate. They have to work together as the 20 clubs or the 24 clubs. They have to, at some point, come together and say, this is what we, all of us, believe. This is our strategic position on this. Even if it's bad for us individually, together we believe this. Individually, we have quite different views. So it's this constant tension between collaborating and competing. That is just doesn't exist in any other industry sector. And then finally, what's happened in sport over the last probably 30 years, I guess, does vary from sport to sport, but roughly over the last 30 years, the importance of broadcasters, television companies, paying telephone numbers of money to buy the television rights to broadcast, and getting quite incredible power by doing this, forcing changes in the sport that is anti-fan. In particular, if you look at the English Premier League, we used to always have the 10 games, 20 clubs, 10 games, all of them played at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Television companies said, well, that's no good to us. It means we can only broadcast 10% of the football. Can't you play your matches at different times? And the Premier League said, whoa, I don't know about that. And the broadcaster said, here's some more money. And the Premier League said, well, OK, yes, probably we could. And they started playing at 5 o'clock on Friday, 11 o'clock on Saturday, 5:30 on Saturday, 11 o'clock on Sunday, 3 o'clock on Sunday. So suddenly we were getting only 4 games being played at 3 o'clock. Broadcaster could only broadcast one of them, but suddenly the other 6 were on at different times, all of which the broadcaster could broadcast. So great for television. They're now able to broadcast 6, or is it 7, of the matches, the 10 matches in the week. But for the fans, this is a disaster. If you lived right down in the south in Southampton and you were playing Newcastle on a Friday night at 5:30, you had to take Friday off work to get to Newcastle. You could not get home on a Friday night, so you had to pay for accommodation in a hotel. The other big factor that was not relevant here, but it's also the price of travel. I was absolutely astounded at how cheap the rail fares are in Finland. They're much higher. So it was another expense, another irritation. If you're already having to spend a lot of money on travel, you didn't want to also have to spend money on accommodation in a hotel. So it was very, very bad for the fans. But television was strong enough, powerful enough, to actually change the game. Most extreme example I know of is, if you think about it, most sport is seasonal and the majority of sport is played in the winter. Now, this is bad for television in the summer. They're saying, oh, what can we show in the summer? There's tennis, there's golf, there's cricket. Oh, hang on, no, that's not going to go very well in Finland, is it? So there's a shortage of summer sport. So again, Sky Sport went to Rugby League and said, look, would you consider changing from being a winter game like rugby union and football and becoming a summer game like cricket? And Rugby League said, you must be joking. And Sky Sport said, well, here's a check. Is that big enough? And they said, yeah, okay. Yeah, we're going to change. We're going to become a summer sport. So a total change in the culture of a sport forced on them. Well, not forced on them. They had their arms twisted, but they gave in to greed, accepted the money. So we've got something funny going on here that simply does not happen. You don't have television companies saying to Lidl or Aldi, would you consider stop selling vegetables? Here's a big contract we'll give you if you stop selling vegetables. I mean, it's just nonsense, isn't it? It's a ridiculous idea. So again, sport is different from mainstream business. Now, I tried very hard to do some kind of personal literature review, as it were, trying to find some kind of theory in the business world that in any way supported this view that sport is beyond being simply a variation on general management. And I came up with this theory. A guy called Spender, he sums up his view as managers often deal with problems that uncertainty creates in ways that are characteristic of that industry. And I will put on this emphasis, characteristic of that industry. What he's really arguing is that each industry is different. There may be some overlap, there may be some similarities, but actually each industry is different, and it doesn't make sense trying to equate them all to some kind of general mainstream theory. If you want to pursue that, there is a link there. I'll arrange for these slides to be circulated. Don't worry about writing that down. Is that going to be okay for... So, yeah, okay. We will make these available to you. So he raises this issue that I was worrying about considerably, what to me was this elephant in the room that no one was actually discussing. Can we generalize? Now, if we look at what has happened in management education, we've had masters in business administration, the MBA, the graduate one for people who have some work experience, and then at undergraduate level, the BA in business studies, BA in business management, whatever variation. All of them assume that there is a common core of skills to do with management and business, and those skills are simply transferable from industry to industry. I don't think many people would disagree that part of that is true. There are some common core skills. Nobody would say accounting cannot be transferred from company to company. The basic accounting skills are the same in every industry. There's nothing industry specific about them. But as Spender was saying, yeah, it's not as simple as that. There are other areas, and I'm certainly saying there are other areas where, no, it doesn't make sense. If you're going to look at marketing, for example, if we're looking at sport, the main thing in marketing you're likely to be looking at is sponsorship. You're going to be looking at merchandising. Now, try and translate that to a supermarket. You don't see several rows of shelves of Aldi selling Aldi T-shirts, Aldi tracksuits, Aldi woolen hats, Aldi scarves. Just doesn't make any sense. They'll give you a free plastic bag if you like, but that's not really merchandising. And they certainly don't have sponsors. You don't go to your local Aldi supermarket and see Aldi sponsored by Coca-Cola. Doesn't work. Coca-Cola does get involved in advertising, but not with the powerful way that sponsors get involved in sport. So Spender is certainly saying, yeah, there are other skills that we need to look at. There is industry knowledge. You can't simply bring in a supermarket manager and make the manager of a football club and say, yeah, he's got a great track record managing a supermarket, so hey, all he's got to do is use those skills in operating a football club. It just doesn't make any sense. If you're going to be a football club manager, then you have to have an industry knowledge. You have to have a network of people that you know. You have to have contacts, not least for introducing new players, hearing what's going on, finding out about new developments in coaching, that kind of thing. You need an industry network to know what's going on. What you want to be aware of is, on the other hand, is too much of, why do you do it that way? Well, that's the way we do it. That's the way we do it around here. There is a danger of this getting locked into your industry recipe, as Spender calls it. So it's both ways that it can be argued. There are elements both ways. But I think Spender does make the main point that you can't simply generalize. You can't simply say there is one set of skills that is sufficient. This is an argument I would certainly apply also in politics. I find it terrifying when I hear on the radio, so-and-so, the Minister for Housing has been appointed Minister for Foreign Affairs. And they're completely different worlds. If he's good at housing, how come suddenly he's good at foreign affairs? Doesn't make any sense at all. So-and-so is Minister for Health. Well, yeah, his background is he's a doctor. I can see some logic in that. But suddenly he's Minister of Culture. Huh? His background as a doctor, that's the right background for being Minister of Culture. It doesn't make sense. You know, there's a definite logic in that some of the skills are simply not transferable, and a lot of it is to do with networking and knowing people and knowing what's going on in an industry. So also sport business isn't actually typical. If you look at general business, most business sectors, they are selling assets and goods. Yes, there are some service sales, but it's more selling assets and goods. They are definitely in it for profit. Aldi doesn't do it because we enjoy giving food to people at the best possible price. They're doing it because they want to make money. And in general, they're large businesses. Not even the likes of Manchester United are large businesses. They may have what seems enormous turnovers, but compare them to the likes of Coca-Cola or Boeing or Dow Chemicals or Lidl. We're talking about really quite small businesses. Even the biggest ones are small, so they do fit into the sport business half. Not for profit, well, and that's, we'll come on to that. Are they actually not for profit? I think in sport, it's very clear that they are less clearly for profit businesses. There are other motivations beyond profit that drive clubs forward. And they are largely in the business of services, unlike most mainstream businesses. They are almost exclusively services, although they do sell some goods, in other words, the merchandising. So yes, there is an overlap, but only a relatively small overlap. So just to kind of summarise, this is very, very generalised. Lots of holes you can find in this argument, lots of exceptions. But in general, we're saying that general business, and therefore their study, is about for-profit organisations, organisations that are selling goods. They are selling to markets and customers. They're generally large firms. And you might label that an industrial kind of management. On the other hand, if we look at sports management, we do tend to characterise it quite differently. Generally, they are, in some sense, not-for-profit. Certainly, there are exceptions. They are selling intangible and perishable services. They can't stockpile and then say, oh, we haven't sold all the tickets for Saturday. Oh, it's Sunday. Do you want to buy yesterday's ticket? We've still got lots available. No, doesn't make sense. They are for members, the clubs, this is. They're for members, fans, supporters. Are they customers? Are they consumers? If you're wearing a business hat, a mainstream business hat, well, yes, they're customers, of course they are. That's classic marketing, isn't it? If, on the other hand, you pick up an economist's hat, well, yes, of course they're consumers. They consume the football service that you offer by playing matches. So to them, they are customers and consumers. Ask a fan, are you a customer or consumer? They will go mad and say, no, we're fans. And, well, I'd have to be honest and say, I think they are a little bit different. Customers and consumers at Aldi or Lidl don't have tattoos, Aldi till I die. They don't worry, I'm not going to do any dramatic, you know, I'm a Portsmouth fan, you can relax, no horrible visions there. But that till I die element, that is so strong in a football fan. I'm a fan of Portsmouth. Portsmouth, who've been doing particularly badly of late, getting it to be a little bit later. I moved away from Portsmouth when I was 20. But I'm Pompey till I die. That was what I grew up with. It's something about being a fan of a club is about local identity. Even though the club today has gone, like all clubs, you know, very international, very commercial, to me, what Pompey the club means, Portsmouth, is my local identity. If I had a tattoo, I would have Pompey till I die. I support other clubs, but I don't have, there's absolutely even less than zero chance I'll get tattoos. So that till I die does make them very difficult to classify with the supermarket consumers. They are in general small firms. Even the really big ones are, by the standards of industry, they're very small. So sport management just comes out with sort of rather different characteristics. If you're just talking objectively about who they are. They're also different sport clubs because the stakeholders don't quite match the stakeholders you find in a supermarket industry. We've got players. Well, I suppose you'd say Aldi have people who put things on the shelves. They have people at the checkouts. I'm not sure they quite equate with players. They don't get transferred for €100,000. They don't get star players. They don't get sponsored by clothing companies or cosmetic companies. So I don't think players quite fit in with that. Clubs. Well, no other industry do you have this kind of club structure, where this competition versus collaboration, and we'll see some rather peculiar motivations and governance. Leagues and governing bodies, well, you probably have some governance going on in most industries of some sort, some kind of professional body regulating what's going on, but you certainly don't have any equivalent of leagues outside sport. You don't have players' associations and players' agents. Well, players' associations, I suppose, you could argue they have an equivalent of trade union. So perhaps there is a similarity there. But certainly not players' agents. However high I might consider myself as an academic, I'll certainly never reach the position, because there isn't one, of having to get myself an agent to represent me in, oh, you want? It's going to speak to my agent. Just never happens. Stadia owners and operators. Well, again, we don't quite have that equivalent in any other industry. It does depend a lot on the sport and the club. But for example, in North America, the owners of the stadium are usually the city and not the club. So you've got this kind of odd separation. Again, that wouldn't happen in a supermarket. You don't have the city builds a supermarket and then invites Aldi and Lidl to compete in who's going to take up the license to use it. Again, you know, it's just a very, very sport thing. Tournaments and event organisers, again, not unique to sport. We certainly have this in the arts and in culture, but we don't have it in mainstream business management. Sports equipment manufacturers, not really any equivalent to that in anything else, because you don't practice anything else. Going to a supermarket, there isn't some kind of amateur shopping that's going on alongside this professional shopping that needs equipment. I don't have to go out and say, now, what's the latest fashion in supermarket baskets? I need an upgrade to a Mark III trolley, because I need a Wi-Fi system on my trolley. It's not like that. And the whole sponsorship system, we don't really find outside of sport. That is a uniquely sport thing. So again, I'm arguing here there is a clear difference. There is a deep blue water difference. Broadcasters, we've mentioned already, is all-powerful, doesn't apply in any other sector. And the whole problematic nature of what is a fan. Is a fan a consumer? Is a fan a customer? Yes and no. They're actually more than that. There is an overlap, but there is also that separate fandom world of the till I die, the tattoos and so on. So what is in particular different about sport is the external stakeholders. These powerful people are not part of the industry. They exist outside the industry. So the three in particular, the broadcasters, the sponsors and the agents. And the agents are rather different from the other two. But the broadcasters and sponsors, big money people putting money into the industry, but expecting something back. They're almost like a customer in some sort of sense. But they're very, very powerful. Too powerful, you might argue, in the case of the broadcasters. What can we say about those three? All of them are a characteristic of what I call the commercialization of sport. I make a big distinction between professionalized sport, which was up until the 90s perhaps, and then after that what I call commercialized sport, where external stakeholders have come in and have some sort of controlling interest in what's going on. In fact, they may have undue influence, too much influence. I think there are certain areas where you can say it's gone a little bit mad. We've given too much power to the broadcaster or the sponsors. We've mentioned the changing the time of games. I've mentioned with rugby league, changing the time of season. deciding when the game take breaks in North America. An 80-minute game usually takes about 2.5 hours because the referee has an earpiece and the broadcaster saying, okay, we want to go to commercial advertising, so stop the game now. And the referee responds to what the broadcaster asked them to do to stop the game. So it's much more stop-start. Again, it's changing the nature of the game, which I think is bad. Forcing kit changes. Again, if this happened to you, you'd probably feel quite strongly about it. Somebody, let's say a footballer, is chosen to represent their country. The footballer has a contract and they're endorsed by Nike, but let's say their national team says, no, you must wear Adidas boots. So you are being told, if you play for your country, you have to have a completely new set of boots that you've never worn before. You're not used to. I think you'd be quite angry about it. And sometimes you get these very strange compromises where you see a player you know is wearing Nike, but you look for the swoosh on their boots and know it's been covered up in tape. And you think, well, you're not really hiding it. You're actually drawing attention to it by doing that. So weird things that just doesn't happen. You don't go into Lidl and find somebody wearing all the uniform but with the badge covered up to pretend they're not from the other supermarket. And what's going on particularly with the agents? Agents are very, very good at their job. They push the price of players up and they also add on a hefty percentage. Not the 10% that a theatrical agent might add on, but sometimes 15, 20, even 30%. So they're really pushing up the price of players, which therefore pushes up the price of tickets. It's very anti-fan having agents in the game. It's very good for players, but very bad for fans. So all of those coming from external stakeholders, people outside the industry who are actually controlling what's going on or seriously influencing what's going on. Right, I mentioned the club. I mean, this is unique in sport. We don't have this concept of the club when we look at other industry sectors. And we use this word really ambiguously. And I've come up with a model. Because I work in a business school, I have to kind of hang on to those old cultural identity things from a business school. If I'm going to develop a model, it has to alliterate. Everything has to begin with the same letter. You're all familiar with the four P's of marketing. That really scares me. I think, what the whole principles of marketing are based on the English language, because supposing the four P's theory had been developed in Germany, in German, it wouldn't be the four P's, would it? But no, it has to be the four P's. In strategy, it has to be the seven S's. So here is my 3C model of the club, and you'll see why I've had problems even with that to get them all to C. So I'm saying we use the word club about actually three different things. There is the fans' view of the club. To them, it's a construct. It's something, a shared belief in people's heads. And it is about identity. It is about till I die. It is about loyalty. It's about going every Saturday, whether they're doing badly or not. It's a kind of loyalty that, again, you're not going to find a loyalty to a supermarket like that. If your baked beans are cheaper in the other supermarket, you go to the other supermarket. If you get bad service, you regularly go to a different supermarket. I'm a Portsmouth fan. If I got fed up with Portsmouth, I would never, ever, ever in my life say, well, what's the alternative? Oh, the nearest club is Southampton. Just impossible. Quite impossible. Also, slightly ridiculous, my parents moved to Portsmouth when I was 4. They could easily have moved to Southampton, given where my father's new job was, but they didn't. They moved to Portsmouth, so that's why I'm a Portsmouth fan till I die. Right, the other second vision of what the club is purely, if you like, the business. That's the owner of the club. Oh dear. getting a rude sign there. I think he means 2 minutes. So I'll try and cut this quickly through then, cut to the chase. I'll just finish this off, in fact, I think, rather than finish the slides off. I'll let you have access to the other slides. So that is the club as business and the owner, and this is the crew. I actually mean the team, but CCT isn't 3C. So they're the crew, like on a ship. They're constantly changing. They actually don't have any loyalty. They will simply go to another club if they get a better offer, but only in the transfer window. So what's going on is quite different. Here we've got a construct. The club is a construct, a vision, a shared vision. We've got the club as a company, and we've got the club as a crew. What they're driven by, what they're about, is quite different. This is actually 3 P's. As a fan, it's about pride and identity. For an owner, it's probably about profit. We're not going to have time to look at that whole dichotomy. And for crew, it's about their performance, how they perform on the pitch. So really, we have to ask the question, this is what I'm not going to look at. Should they seek profit or should they seek performance, utility maximization? Probably both. Right, so we're not going to look at this. But I will just finish on this. The different models of how leagues are constructed and operated, there are at least 4 different models, and they answer questions about who are they operated, for whose benefit. Now, you never ask that about any other mainstream business. It's for the benefit of the owner to make a profit. But if we look at sport, it's different in different systems. In Germany, football clubs are operated by the fans for the fans. There is a fan ownership in place under their regulations. In the UK, the benefactor model, the rich owner model, so it's operated by a rich owner for his or her own benefit, which might be profit, it might be glory. They simply want to be famous. They've made their money somewhere else. They would rather lose it, throwing it at a football club, than paying taxes as profit in their main business. If we look at the Spanish model, then it's an elected representative of the fans who runs it, on their behalf, which all sounds terribly democratic, but in fact it's basically an elected dictator for 5 years. They only ever elect rich men. The left-wing socialist candidate always gets 0 in a Spanish football club election. Then finally, North America, this is much more like mainstream business. It's run by business people for their own benefit. They are straightforward businesses making profits. Fans are almost kind of incidental in the model of how they operate. Right, just to finish on a different version of my pet theory that one size does not fit all. And that's perhaps the ultimate example. So as far as I'm concerned, my conclusions are very straightforward. There is some overlap, yes, between mainstream business and sport business, but equally clearly there are some areas where you simply cannot apply mainstream business and vary it, twist it a little bit, tweak it and say, oh, sport management is just a variation. So there's an interesting tension there, but it is to me very definitely the elephant in the room. We don't debate this whole question, this whole notion of how different is it, where is it different. The EU tried to bring it on their agenda with their white paper and the Treaty of Lisbon, but have they made any progress since then? No. Will they? I'm not holding my breath. Okay, we'll finish there before I get any really rude gestures. So, any questions? Yes.
Is it something that has to be dealt with like a basis for
it? I think there are very few examples you can say of monopoly. There is a danger of it becoming monopoly in sports broadcasters. The Rupert Murdoch family of broadcasters, in particular Sky, have got dangerously close to that. They've actually tried to follow a logical mainstream business strategy of vertical integration. As broadcasters, they've tried to buy clubs. They tried to take over, I think it was Newcastle, and the British government stepped in and said, no, this is against the public interest, and said a broadcaster can only buy 10% of a football club. Otherwise, there is too much power concentrated as a monopoly. Whether sports broadcasting is actually a monopoly under Sky, or whether it's more clearly an oligopoly with competitors like ESPN and so on and some of the American companies, my personal thoughts are it's too near a monopoly for it to be comfortable for me. And I don't even like it being an oligopoly. The problem is with broadcasters, you have to be big to be a sports broadcaster. There are enormous entry barriers. I couldn't go out there with, let's say, my redundancy money, if I was made redundant, say, right, I'm going to invest in a satellite. I'm going to become a broadcaster. You have to be mega rich. So I don't think there are going to be many new competitors. So I think it's going to drift from oligopoly towards even more monopoly. Do I think that's good or bad? It's definitely bad, because I think it's anti-fan. And I think, to me, sport is much more, the kind of sport I'm talking about is much more about the fan. I'm not talking about participative sport. I'm talking about spectator sport. Should be much more for the fan. Just to point out, if you do need to contact me, my email is on the slide, so please do, and I am on Twitter. But that's on Twitter, I'm only talking about English football finance.